Bishus Marina, Rav Shlita. It doesn't matter if you've missed the first two of our series. We're talking in general terms. The Abikaris is the denier, and we gave various definitions as to what an Abikaris might be. But as Norman Taylor correctly pointed out, sometimes we have to be careful to watch out the Abikaris which is within ourselves. We said in our first part of our series that the true way of dealing with an Abikaris is not to debate with him at all, not to answer him at all, but to ignore him. But if a person gets certain thoughts or ideas which may be heretical, then that person should know how to respond to them, because Yiddishkeit is not a religion where you're just told, do as you're told and don't ask. You're encouraged to ask. The Shas is full of questions. So if you've got these questions, we are dealing in some way as to how to answer them. Last time we started speaking about Nifloas HaBore, and maybe we'll deal today with that and with other aspects. But in talking about the deniers generally, I was told just last night of an event that happened in St. John's Wood many years ago when Rabbi Israel Brody was the chief rabbi. And Rabbi Brody was just walking into St. John's Wood Synagogue on a Shabbos morning, and a car drew up next to him, and it was somebody who couldn't find his way to the liberal synagogue. And he, there in St. John's Wood, he asked Rabbi Brody, excuse me, could you please tell me the way to the liberal synagogue? So Rabbi Brody answered, it's near the cricket ground, but it's not on the Lord's side. Anyway, when we finished off last time, we were talking about the amazing mathematical pattern of the honeycomb, which is created by the bee, and how amazing scientists have been oogling over it for a long time, thousands of years, until only very recently some mathematician proved that the honeycomb is the most efficient way of creating a system for the honey, which is surrounded by the beeswax, and it's the most economical way of manufacturing the honeycomb. Of course, bees need honey to feed on during the winter. They manufacture it, and we have honey to derive from them. But there are other amazing things about the bee. Why talk about the bee? Well, I've got to home in on something. And there are so many fascinating ideas about the bee. There is no way anybody could suggest that such a thing has come about by accident. The brain of the honeybee is much greater than any supercomputer. A supercomputer computes at the rate of 1 billion computations per second. The brain of the honeybee can compute at 1 billion computations in 1,000th of a second, or a trillion computations per second. Similarly, the housefly can compute at 10 to the power 11 computations.
How do you know?
Well, let me finish, and then you will ask. The way the bee is constructed, it's got upper and lower outside portions of hind legs equipped with plates that are designed to hold and to transport pollen. The plates have a hollowed out area in the knee on both the upper and lower segments. There are hairs which reach around the hollowed out areas on the upper and lower segments, form a basket-like structure in order to transport the pollen. Remember, of course, that if we wouldn't have bees, we wouldn't really have food to eat because of the pollination which they do for flowers, from flowers to fruits and vegetables. And although there may be some other creatures who do kinds of pollination, it's the bee which we really have to rely upon. The loading of the pollen is accomplished primarily through the use of a comb that's placed on the inside of the knee. And then that knee is entirely different from the outside. It contains no concave surfaces for storing pollen or long hairs to hold it, because the knee is designed to transport only on the outside. It's designed in this way in order to provide the bee with the ability to preen the pollen off the numerous hairs on the body to load the pollen into the pollen holders. These can't be things which are called accidents. That the Abikarsim of the world are saying, well, anything can happen over billions of years and things can develop. When you look at the way the bee works, I mean, the eye of the bee, its vision, it has an ultralight power. The bee has this power to work out from the North Pole and South Pole with magnetic ideas how it can travel around, and it knows its way around, just like a GPS. In fact, more sophisticated than any sat-nav system. Its compound eye contains approximately 4,500 tiny lenses in minute hexagonal chambers which record the type of light that's needed for the bee in order to get around, and only the light that's directly in line with the direction of its lens. So it knows its way around, it knows its way back to its beehive, it knows how to tell other bees where to go for the best flowers by giving them the directions, like a grid reference, as to where to go in order to get the best flowers. So the bee has the ability to read the Earth's magnetic field to determine its direction. There are so many things written about the bees that you need thousands and thousands of files to explain how it is built in such an amazing and intelligent way. Its brain processes its information from millions of sources. And how would you know that there's a magnetic field which is perceived before the receptors, the neurons, the code that relays magnetic perceptions, and its processing power to read the code accidentally? That is impossible. And there are various kinds of light which it uses. If there's no light, it can find around its way in the dark. If its ultraviolet light is weak, it's got a neuroprocessing power to read and to assimilate and to analyze and to react to these codes at a trillion computations per second. How great are the works of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Mor Abu Ma'asecho Hashem. In fact, you might see in some health food stores something called propolis. The Beis Din has said that propolis is kosher, like honey is. They discovered that the bees were taking from the nectar and the pollen something called propolis, which they coat around the outside of the beehive to fight infections. Because you've got so many thousands of bees on top of each other that if there's an infection, that it'll kill the whole lot of them. So this propolis protects them from infection. And so you get in these health food stores propolis tablets or drops as an idea of fighting infection. Anyway.
Does it work?
Well, I only can talk from personal experience that when I take two propolis tablets every day, I never get the flu. GPS is not just something which you find in bees to find the perfect flower with the exact location. I mean, if we ask ourselves what's the most amazing invention which we've got into modern technology, in my opinion, it's the GPS. So you can press a button and type in an address and you're just told where to go. It's fantastic. But the GPS system inside the bee or inside bats is far more sophisticated than any GPS system that we have. In fact, with bats, they can find their way around by sending out these sonar waves which reflect back at them, and they can even tell which insects are around them, and they even know which kinds of insects and whether these insects are alive or dead, and they know exactly where to find them in order to eat them. And it's only recently, in the last 10 years, that some scientists have discovered the sat-nav system inside bats, how complicated it really is. In Munich University they did a study on this, that they've got this internal navigation system to emit these ultrasound pulses to measure the echoes, and that the neurons in their brain measure distances from objects, and that they've got like a spatial map inside their brain. And Dr. Uwe Ferslaff of Munich University said that this is far more sophisticated than any new system we have for GPS in cars, and far more sophisticated to warn them of any impending collisions. So that's just a little taste of what we're talking about with Niflaos HaBore. But we'll carry on a little bit more with that. You know, we talk on Seder night, and we'll soon speak about the ideas of the miracles and Sipur, of telling stories. The idea of Seder night is telling stories. But really, when it comes to Niflaos HaBore, we've got the same idea, because David HaMelech says, HaShomayim Mesapurim Kavod Kael. The Maaseh Yodov Magid Lorakia. Where do we have this word Magid? We have it on Seder night, but it's also on the wonders of nature, of Hashem's creations. I may have once spoken about a certain scientist, a non-Jewish scientist called Edward Behe, B-E-H-E. Behe wrote a number of books to show how things cannot be accidental in the nature which surrounds us. And his mushel, which he uses, is that of a mouse trap. He says, because the mousetrap has certain components in it, and it can't function without all those components with the right size and the right proportions. So when you have a mousetrap, you've got the wooden platform, which is the base. You've got a metal hammer, which crushes the mouse. You've got a spring, which is pressed against the hammer when the trap is charged. You've got a catch, which releases it when there's the slightest of pressure. And you've got the metal bar, which connects the catch and holds the hammer back. And you need each component. The mousetrap can't function without all those components at the right place, at the right proportion. So that if one part is missing, nothing will work. And he says, this is how you can understand how God's creations are, in essence, so complete that there's no way anyone can suggest that these things developed over millions of years. It's impossible. Because if the human eye is only formed in part, just like the mousetrap is only formed in part, then it couldn't function. And he gives some other examples. He talks about blood clotting. When, unfortunately, you get a wound on your finger, yeah, and it bleeds, and you get the blood to stop, that's part of the blood clotting process. And then what happens? It heals up. Well, if it doesn't clot enough, then you will bleed to death. If it clots too much, a clot can kill by giving you a stroke. So you need that perfect balance, where each protein depends on activation by another, and he compares it to a plane landing on a very short runway. And that plane is on autopilot, remember? Right? So you need just that right balance. So when people say, well, the tissue appears and the protein is unleashed, how does it all happen in balance with each other? That there is a whole mechanism involving thousands of different concepts inside your body to make it work with a correct balance to heal up your wounds. He writes that the chances of a wound healing by chance is 10 to the power of 18. That means that if you have 1 million players in a lottery, it'll take 1,000 billion years for one person to win. That's 10 to the power of 18. And if that is not a big enough number to surprise you, that when you eat your food, that food translates itself into your personal DNA, because you've got your own system to adapt to. And Professor Aaron Vech said to me that the chances of that happening by chance is 10 to the power of 60, if you could work out what that is. Rabbi Victor Miller was perhaps one of the first ones in the last 40, 50 years to write about how the wonders of nature should be looked at with such amazement. And he wrote this before DNA was discovered. And he spoke about the apple pip. The pip of the apple, he said, if you would write 10,000 volumes to explain how the pip of the apple works, it would still not be enough to explain how it works. Edward Baer talks about the immune system. In order for a person's immune system to function, that system has to recognize every single illness in the body, or which could potentially come to the body, in order to know how to fight it. So there are thousands and even millions of files, so to speak, inside your immune system to know how to create antibodies to fight a particular illness. It's unfortunate when people become ill, it's because their immune system is not functioning properly. And that's how serious illnesses come about, because of a lack in the immune system. So we are walking around, all of us, miraculously, with various components in our immune system. And that immune system has to have at least three components. One is the antibody, two is the messenger, because there has to be something going back to the source, to the filing system, to know how to send out those antibodies. And thirdly, that there's the exported form of the antibody with the genetic information of your personal DNA. And if any part of that is missing, then your immune system can't function. So you need multiple components in the right proportions, in the right locations, like the blood clotting, to know how to react. This is, he says, like the mousetrap. So Professor Andy McIntosh wrote from Leeds University, he says, the rise in knowledge about the real facts make the logical coded machinery of DNA and the information system it carries shout design to an unprejudiced mind. So there is something which one can spend a whole year or 10 years or 20, 30, 40 years just on this very subject. As we mentioned last time, when we say in the Akdomus on Shavuos, if all the seas of the world were ink and all the quills, all the feathers of the world were made into quills to write with, and all the peoples of the world were scribes, there would not be enough to describe the Nifloas Habore, the wonders of creation. And this is all part of answering the Apicurus. So you'll say to me, well, why is it that there are so many people who deny HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and they just go around without accepting all these Nifloas Habore? How is this possible? Rabbi Chonon Wasserman writes about Shochad. He says the people walk around and they are blinded by their own Taivas in Olam Hazeh. That people have prejudices because they don't want commitment. So if I do you a little favor, I'm not allowed to be your judge in a law court. The slightest favor, because I may become prejudiced. The whole concept of bribery is, of course, well documented in Kosher Mishpat. But what he's saying is that in this Musa sense of the word, that people are bribed by their inclinations, and they therefore don't have a very clear vision. Rav Twersky writes that if our youngsters would receive a short lesson on the wonders of nature before they start their Gemara Shia, they would learn it much better. They grow up, and unfortunately, they might know Hilchas Shabbos, but they do not understand the existence and functioning of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and His Torah in this world. If you learn Hilchas Yesod HaTorah, you'll see the Rambam writes that you should learn the Nifloas Habore, the wonders of Hashem's creation. Look at the rain cycle. Look at the way plants grow. Look at the way sea functions. Some years ago there was this terrible tsunami in the Far East. And before the tsunami came, all the animals which were grazing near the sea walked up the hill. They avoided it. They knew. Whereas the idiotic human beings were just sunbathing there without thinking of anything else. And they couldn't see it as any message. And people got killed and so on when this earthquake came with the waves coming in and the tsunami. It was dreadful. How did these animals know? They know things that we do not know.
They feel the vibrations.
Pardon?
They feel the vibrations.
Okay, so they got seismic technology which we don't have. But that's all the Nifloas Habore subject. I would like to move on. We've just come out from Hanukkah. And Hanukkah is Bayomim Mahim Bazman Hazeh, and we say Al HaNisim. And there are some miracles which appear to go against the laws of nature and some which don't. But we say on Hanukkah, Rabin bi'ad me'atim, Shemayim bi'ad tarim, against all odds with the Milchoma, against the Yavonim, we succeeded. And that we recognize the hand of Hashem. So we got on Hanukkah this idea of Parsumei Nisov, publicizing the miracle. So that the Hanukkah light is lit to show everybody outside. Because we're doing this publication, so to speak. When else do we do Parsumei Nisa? On Seder night. But on Seder night, it's to people around the table, in the family. And we are publicizing the miracle of the coming out of Egypt. When else do we do Parsumei Nisa? On Purim, we read the Megillah. But that's to the community, in the shul. So you've got different kinds of Parsumei Nisa, of publicizing a miracle. Why? Because Pesach, when we sit around the table, the Korban Pesach was instructed as to be l'mishpachos eichem, for your family. So we sit around the table as a family. Purim, Haman accused us of being amufuzo meforod beinu amim. We're a scattered people. So we read the Megillah as a community. Ki'ish echod b'lev echod. Hanukkah was an attack from Hellenism, from outside the faith, to challenge our faith, to challenge our emunah. So that's why we show the light to the outside world, more so than into our own home. Although there's a bit of a difference of opinion, but the original takana is the light outside, and certainly when you write light in the window, you're displaying the lights outside. So you've got Parsumei Nisa. What's the idea of Parsumei Nisa? We have to go back to our sources of Yehuda HaLevi. And he writes the Kuzari. And the Khuzri decides to question the various religions of the world because the king of the Khazars has a dream. And in this dream, he realizes, he's told, that his intentions are fine, but his actual actions are not correct. So he decides to search the world for truth. So he questions the philosopher, he questions the Christian, he questions the Muslim. We won't go into all their dialogues now, but when the Khuzar realizes that he's not getting satisfactory answers, he says, well, I may as well go and ask the Jew, even though he's a despised race. And the Jew answers, I believe in the God of Avram, Yitzchak and Yaakov, who showed us signs and wonders and who brought us out from the land of Egypt, who took us through the Midbar for 40 years, who fed us with the man. The Khuzri says, hold on a minute. What about the creation? What about the God who created the world? So the Jew is basically saying, well, I wasn't there at the time. Yes, we believe in the Niflaot HaBorei, what we've just been discussing, in the wonders of creation. But we were there. We were actually witnesses to the Nisim which happened. We were the witnesses to amazing events, and we are the only people in the world who had revelation on a public scale, on a massive scale. The other religions, they had one individual who claimed he had visions. We don't have individuals who had visions. We go by the whole public. But there were 600,000 men at Krios Yamsuf. They were married with five kids approximately. So that makes 3 million people. If you get a fact recorded in history of so much multitude, then that is compelling evidence. That is eidos. And there's another aspect to this. It creates the idea of our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu as a personal God. The nations of the world, how do they perceive God when they do believe in God? They see him as the creator, as somebody who's distant from ourselves. And we see this recently in our Parshias, where Yosef is called before Paro to interpret his dreams. And Yosef says, Elokim yane es shalom Paro. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Elohim. He doesn't say Yud Kei Vav Kei, the name of Hashem, as we usually refer to it. He says Elohim. And the word Elohim is used 7 times in that story. So much so that Paro himself is influenced by what Yosef HaTzadik says by using the word Elohim himself twice. What is this idea of Elohim? There was something written about this just last week by Rabbi Jonathan Sachs in his Covenant and Conversation. He says the nations of the world, when they perceive God, they perceive Elohim as the one who is the one who creates nature. But we have something a bit more than that. We've got a personal relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is the Yud Kei Vav Kei, which is the Midas Rachamim, and which is the personalized God. And this was the difficulty that Albert Einstein had. There was something in the news recently about Albert Einstein, and they put on auction a letter that he wrote. And it went for, I don't know, $1 million or something like that. And in this letter, he spoke about how he can understand the God of nature. He accepted the idea of the wonders of the world. A big scientist that he was, he understood and accepted God of nature. But he couldn't come to terms with the idea of a personal God. A Yiddish boy, Einstein, you know, a Yiddish boy. He wrote this theory of relativity. One Yid in Stavridel asked another Yid, what is this Einstein theory of relativity? What does it mean? And he says, I'll tell you what it means. It means that if you're sitting on a hot oven, 1 minute feels like a whole hour. But if you're sitting with a woman whom you love, then 1 hour feels like 1 minute. And this fellow says, what? And this is how this guy earned a living? Right. So he couldn't come to understand the idea of a personal God. When we come to eidos of witnessing Hashem's miracles, whether it's by the idea of Hanukkah or Pesach and Kriyas Yamsuf, the man in the wilderness for 40 years to sustain a whole people, that is eidos. That's something which we've seen. And if you say, well, you and I were not there, I didn't see it personally, then alright, did you see the Battle of Hastings in 1066? Everyone knows that there was a Battle of Hastings in 1066. But how do you know? I wasn't there. Well, it's recorded as a fact in the history books. And because it's recorded as a fact in the history books, the whole concept of the Kuzari is that our emunah is based on our experience, our personal experience. And not necessarily on all these wonders of nature. I'm talking about bees and bats. However wonderful and amazing they are, we can appreciate HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but our personal emunah and our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is based on our experience. That is the essence of the Sefer HaKuzari by Yehuda HaLevi. A most amazing work. But this idea which comes out from the Kuzari cannot easily be understood unless I give you a certain example. Because, yes, it's a very nice idea. Millions of people see something. We're the only people who saw Revelation. We saw Kriyas Yamsuf. Went against the laws of nature. We saw the 10 Makkos in Mitzrayim. We saw the Mon in the Midbar, and so on and so forth. I mean, in the davening, we say, HaMachadosh B'tuvah B'chol Yom Tomid Ma'aseh Bereishis. Hashem renews every day His Nisim. But why do we sit round the table on Seder night and make it the highlight of the year? To tell the story. Even if we're wise people and we can think with great philosophy, like Albert Einstein did, even if we know the Torah, we should tell a story. Just like the Meshomayim is Mesaprim Kibod Kel and Magid Harokia, so we've got on Seder night and Pesach the idea of telling a story. Because when you tell the story, you are instilling inside people the idea of the experience and the idea of their munah. Nothing complicated, no PhD thesis. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman writes in Kohet Mamorim, you don't have to be a high intellectual to have a munah. That's not what emunah is. Emunah is seeing the plain truth. And if somebody comes along afterwards and tries to refute that it happened, the whole idea of the Christians, Muslims saying they come from us is because our story is so compelling. You can't deny it when 3 million people have seen a fact in history, just like you can't deny it that 1066. And in future generations, it won't be denied that the majority of this country voted for Brexit. It's a fact. Now, there are facts, and then there are opinions, and then there are lies. So if somebody comes along with lies and tries to refute the facts which everybody knows, that person can be disproved. Now, something happened in the last 10, 20 years which articulates in my mind the whole concept of this Kuzari and the whole concept of Eidus. There's a professor in California called Devora Lipstadt. She's a Jewish historian. And some people came to her about 30 years ago and said, why don't you do research on the idea of Holocaust denial? And she said, denial of the Holocaust? She had already written books about the Holocaust. She said, but denial? What do you need denial for? You've got so many witnesses with their testimonies. You've got the tattoos on their arms from Auschwitz. We've got the Polish goyim who watched the Jews being loaded on trucks and being carried away never to return to their homes. What do you need to have a book about Holocaust denial for? And they said to her, we need it. We need it. Because now we're getting people who are calling themselves the revisionists. They don't call themselves Nazis or anti-Semites or Jew-haters. They call themselves the revisionist historians, where we correct the facts. Because, as she said, there are facts, there are opinions, and there are lies. And what they do is they try to change first the opinions. And as they change the opinions, then they manage to smuggle in the lies. So she wrote a book, and it was published by Penguin UK, about Holocaust denial. And it was about 20 years ago, less actually, in the year 2000, 2001, she got a letter from Penguin UK saying, we received a summons to a libel suit by someone called David Irving, Yirach Shemo, who is suing you. She said, what? What's he suing me for? He says, because you called him a Holocaust denier, and that what he wrote in his books about denying the concentration camps and the gas chambers, you said that he's telling the the falsehoods. She couldn't believe it. So what do you do? And the problem with the UK court, why did he bring the case in a UK court and not in an American court where she was living? Because in the UK court, the onus is on the one who brings the case to prove that there is a libel. In the United Kingdom court, the onus is on the victim, on the defendant, to prove that what he said or what she said is true. So the onus was on Devorah Lipschut. And she came here to England and she sat down with the lay leaders of the Jewish community and they said to her, don't do it, don't fight it. She said, I've got no choice, what do I do? They said, don't fight it, it can go against us and it would be terrible. She fought it. They made a film out of this story called Denial. And I think it only came out 2 or 3 years ago. And how does the story run? And there was this whole trial before a high court judge and the libel, and he tried to prove this and he tried to prove that. He defended himself, he brought all his papers, and she showed how the footnotes in his books were relating back to sources which didn't exist. But the way the trial was going, it felt like, oh, this is very worrying. And the way the newspapers were grabbing onto it, about that something wasn't proven about to do with the gas chambers or whatever it was. To cut a long story short, the judge issued his ruling. The judge said that David Irving is a racist, he's a liar, there is no case to answer. Now, in itself, that was an amazing case, that was an amazing story. But what I find the most amazing aspect of it all is that it reinforces what the Khuzri writes about Emunah. That when you have a fact which is so well established, nobody can challenge it. Because however many lies that somebody tries to come along and bring, it can't work. Because the facts are in history that they were accepted by so many people, and when they were accepted by so many people, then it's an untruth. But sadly, the young generation are growing up in the outside world, and they're not even told about the Holocaust. They don't even know what it was. There's no education going on about it. And as part of the mitzvah of remembering our Molech, it is our duty to make sure that what happened must be known about to all future generations. So that's the idea of Eidos. Eidos means that we have witnessed something. My mother saw her shul burning down in Frankfurt on Main in November 1938. She saw 22 relations of hers going no further than first cousins being taken away and never being brought back. She knew what was going on. Baruch Hashem, she managed to escape with her family through the kindness of Rabbi Dr. Schoenfeld. But there were many who didn't make it. But this idea of facts being convoluted into lies is something which is very important in the idea of what is truth. What is honesty? Whether we're talking about Niflaot HaBorei and the wonders of creation, or whether we're talking about the Eidos, it's all about honesty. David HaMelech recognized there were both aspects which can deal with answering the Abikoros. One is the amazing things about the Niflaot HaBorei. What did he write? Mikolos Mayim Rabim Adirim Mishpreyom Adir Bamor Hashem. When you look at exalted nature, Mikolos Mayim Rabim Adirim, you become Adir Bamor Hashem. You become so high up about feeling Hashem, about experiencing Hashem. But then he writes, Eidosecho, the Eidos, what we witness, Nem Numa Od, the Emunah is even far, far greater. Because it's our personal relationship with our Kodesh Baruch Hu. The Yudke Vovke are not just the Elohim. So you've got those two kinds of Emunah there. The wonders of Hashem's nature and the Eidos. And the two together he encapsulates in one Pasuk. Mikolos Marim Rabim Adirim. Avraham Avinu, unfortunately, didn't see the Nisim. He wasn't there yet. He was before everything that happened afterwards with the Nisim Nigloim. So how did he recognize Hashem? He saw nature. He studied trees. He saw the rain cycle. He saw how insects work. He saw the bee. He saw that everywhere there was a voice shouting out, an intelligence, a super intelligence shouting out, I was here. So he benefited from the first part of David HaMelech's Pasuk, Mikolos Mayim Rabbi Madirim. He didn't get the Eidus. And what does it say in the Pasuk? Vayero Elov Hashem Be'elone Mamre. HaKadosh Baruch Hu appeared to Avraham Avinu Mamre. Roshei Tevos Mikolos Mayim Rabbim Adirim. That's how he got his emunah. We are benefiting from more than what Avraham Avinu had, because we've got the Eidus, we got the Pasuk Minissa, we got the Seder night to tell this to ourselves and to our children and our grandchildren. And these are the strongest ways of talking, if we do talk, to the Abikoros. As I said, the best way is to steer clear. But as Norman said, there may be an Abikoros within ourselves who we should know how to answer. That ends part 3 of our series. I have not managed to finish everything I wanted to say. I do suffer from verbal diarrhea, so I'm going to have to continue this series for a part 4 next time. Thank you.